Are you ready to take your business to the next level? Then you've come to the right place. You're listening to the My Accountant Handles That podcast, presented by The Quantify Group, the podcast that covers all aspects of running the financial side of your business. And now, your hosts, longtime CPAs, Dave Ashworth and Alex Steinberg.
Welcome to the My Accountant Handles That podcast. I am your co-host, Dave Ashworth. I'm here with my other co-host and business partner, Alex Steinberg. Alex, what's going on, man?
Hey, everybody. Thanks for being here again. Yep, we're great guest today.
We do. We have an awesome guest today. Really successful entrepreneur, started at a really young age. We're super excited. So let's dive right in. I'm going to read his bio real quick, introduce him, and then we'll dive right in. So our guest today is David Zamarin, and I'm going to read his bio real quick. So, driven to overcome the challenges faced by immigrant parents, David has made a name for himself as the founder of DetraPel, the latest in a series of ventures that appeared on season 9 of ABC's hit show Shark Tank. He also co-founded two other companies that he has since exited out of. The recent Babson College alum was considered as one of Philadelphia's Entrepreneurs of the Year in 2016 at age 18. A member of several advisory boards, David seeks to give back as well. He coached a youth soccer team, sat on the Youth Advisory Council of SEPTA, sat on the advisory board of Brighton Public School, and does numerous speaking engagements while mentoring at several youth entrepreneurship programs. David's background and innovative entrepreneurial spirit make him an accomplished and inspiring leader, as he's always looking to get involved in more. David, thanks so much for being on the podcast today. Yeah, for sure, for sure. So, man, it's so cool to see, like, just an entrepreneur like yourself that's just had so much success at such a young age. So I want to definitely dive into some of that. Obviously, I read your bio, but I want to kind of pass it to you real quick. Just give a little bit more about your background, kind of what you're up to today, and what led you on such kind of an entrepreneurial journey.
My bio kind of touches upon it. Like, I come from an immigrant family, and so I watched my parents struggle really early on, and my parents got divorced when I was 2. So my dad was doing pretty well for himself, and my mom was really struggling working 17-hour shifts. So for me, I just really wanted to be independent from them. And so I had this entrepreneurial spirit because I really learned from my dad. My dad's been an entrepreneur his whole life. I've just been learning from him. And then my mom pushed so much education on me that I was fortunate enough to get into one of the best schools in the country, which is the top school in PA. It's a public school, but it's called Masterman, and I went there for middle school and high school, and I really wanted to stand out. I really wanted to be unique, especially knowing that, you know, I was going to be applying to colleges, and all my peers and friends, they all had the same resume as I did. We all did, like, you know, 12 different clubs, all state champs, and, you know, whether it's athletics, mock trial, debate, you name it, we all had the credentials. So the only thing that really differentiated us was, I mean, really nothing. So I realized that my freshman year of high school, and I got involved with a youth entrepreneurship program outside of school, which was held at First Round Capital, which is a venture capital firm in Philly and one of the largest in the U.S., and got direct mentorship from some of the people that were in the offices. And so that was a really kind of groundbreaking experience for me. I was always entrepreneurial. I had other businesses growing up, but my first real business was my freshman year of high school, thanks to that program.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So tell us a little more about your company DetraPel, kind of what you're you know, doing today, and you know, if you have any other things that you're working on, and then we'll kind of dive into some other questions based off that.
Yeah, sure. So DetraPel is a protective coatings company. We create coatings that can be applied to virtually any surface, and particularly fabrics, and they can repel any liquid-based substance. So for example, you can spray this on, like, your couch or your shoes or whatever, and you can pour something like syrup on it, and it'll roll right off. And it's meant to protect and prolong the life of all your belongings, so thereby saving you money. And we do so, we do so by being really the only company in the world that does this, but we create these coatings without fluorochemicals, which is the acronym is PFAS, which there's 5,000 families of these chemicals, which are all very, very dangerous and lead to cancer and birth defects. And it's a serious major issue with all the competition out there. So our IP is around having really the world's first and only completely PFAS free protective coating that is still as effective, if not better, than the competition.
Yep. Yep. No, that's awesome. So I got to ask, how did you kind of land in that field? How did you get into this? I'm sure there's something behind that there.
Yeah, there definitely is. My freshman year of high school, when I got accepted to Masterman, my grandparents bought me two pairs of Jordans as my gift. Mm-hmm. And again, I come from my parents were doing well. My mom was doing well off then. She eventually went to school and became a civil engineer. So she was doing fine at that point. But you know, I grew up with a mentality where we didn't have money. So I took a lot of care of my shoes. And in particular, when I got the Jordans, I really didn't want to get them dirty and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to come up with a film that could be peeled off whenever they got dirty, but I didn't know anything about chemistry. So one of my mentors suggested that I start a shoe cleaning business for local university sports teams in Philly. And that's what I did. I ran this company called Lick Your Soul and for 4 months straight. And then on the fourth month, we were making like $25,000 a month in revenue and I was alone, super profitable. Mm-hmm. And you know, at first I didn't want to clean shoes. I thought that was pretty disgusting, but I swallowed the pride and I ended up doing it. And it proved to be a really good business idea. And then I got an opportunity to sell the company. So I took it immediately. And I started pursuing the idea of using, you know, coatings to protect the stuff so that they wouldn't get dirty in the first place. And so I came across a competitor at the time that was using nanotechnology. And that was really the first time that nanotechnology became available in the consumer market. And so I started doing research on it. And one of the benefits of being at Masterman was that if you were at Masterman and you upheld your grades, you were allowed to be a part-time undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania. So I was able to take classes as a high school student, pretty much as an undergraduate student at Penn. And so I based the 3 years of my studies at Penn on economics and chemistry. And so that's really where the original idea and the research and everything came from. And then eventually, we became where we are today.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now are you, so you exited that company, obviously, then you got into this, which is awesome. Now, is your product going direct to consumer, or are you selling it to businesses, or a combination of both?
So we target all three verticals. We have business to consumer, direct to consumer, and business to business. And the difference between business to consumer and direct to consumer for us is business to consumer to us is considered retail. And direct to consumer is obviously website, online sales, direct third-party sales that directly go to the consumer. And then B2B is to manufacturers. So for example, we have, we have a carpet manufacturer, which is one of the largest in the US. Yeah. And you know, they pre-treat all their carpets and rugs before they sell them. And then for anything that's outstanding, they have a service-based business where people come in and clean those high-end rugs. And those people have that treatment option as well.
So
we work with manufacturers as well. And that's really, this year, that's been the majority of the business.
Yep.
Last year, because of Shark Tank, 80% of our business was consumer.
Right.
But it's, you know, that's where we think the real money is long term.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that sounds like a heck of an idea for like carpets. I mean, I'm looking at some carpets now that are not looking great. So could he use that on mine?
Yeah.
So I know you touched on, I know Alex has a follow-up question to this, but Shark Tank, man, I bet that had to be pretty cool. So tell us about that experience. How did that come about? What was that like? And then I think Alex has a couple follow-up questions, more specific to that. But
sure.
Got to hear about Shark Tank.
Yeah, I mean, it was a life-changing opportunity. And the way that it happened for me was when I was a sophomore in high school, when I started Detropel, I was looking into some of the VCs that were at First Round Capital, and one of them named Chris Fralick had a Forbes article about how to get a hold of the busiest people that you know on, and it was a video. And so I watched the video, and then there was also an article, and it gave you literally 10 steps on how to craft the perfect email. And I did that. I replicated that. I emailed him. He responded, and I was like, oh, cool. So I emailed the head of the firm, who I kind of knew, so I was kind of expecting a response. But I got a response from him, and I said, you know, kind of screw it. Let's go big or go home. And I at the time, I learned what email hunting was and data mining, and I really learned a lot about that. And I was able to find and mine Mark Cuban's email.
Wow.
And so I cold emailed Mark Cuban, and he responded. Wow. And then in my follow-up email, I mentioned that I wanted to go on Shark Tank eventually. And he introduced me to the casting producer, who then followed my story for the next 4 years after that, because we were not ready for Shark Tank at the time. And then finally, when we were ready, you know, they asked us, are you ready to apply this year? And we said, you know what? Yeah, we are. And so in 2017, we applied. Then we filmed, and the episode aired early January of 2018.
Wow. Man, cold email to Mark Cuban.
It's amazing.
That's pretty cool. That's awesome, man. That's awesome. So what was the result? You know, what happened?
Yeah, what were the positives and negatives of the whole experience?
Okay, good question. And I'm going to be careful, because there's certain things I cannot say.
Yeah, that's understood.
But from positives, and the experience in general was awesome. I mean, yeah. I closed one of the quickest deals in history. So we had a deal in about 32 minutes, I believe. Okay. And so that's relatively really quick for the tank and for general pitching, obviously. But we walked in, you know, I walked in and gave the pitch, and it went really well. I mean, they really liked it. And for every question, I got like another 10 compliments. It was really sweet to have that support, because it finally meant, you know, everything that I had been working for the last, at that point, I think it was 5 years or four and a half. I think it was 5 years. 2017. No, it was 4 years at that point. Yeah, it was 4 years at that point. And it was good to see that everything was validated, you know, everything that we were working on and all the research that it took and all that stuff. So it was really, really cool. And the pros were, you know, that it completely changed the life of the company. I mean, after Shark Tank, seeing that we had one of the more successful episodes, and, you know, we had sharks fighting over us, we had 4 out of the 5 sharks offer us a deal. Wow. I took a deal with Mark Cuban and Lori Grenier. And you know, things went really, really well, and the episode aired, and we had a ton of customers. And so the pros were that the company really took off, and we were able to really grow into a real company, not just a business or a startup or an idea. And we ended up transitioning. At the time, we were in a 4,000 square foot facility in Massachusetts, which is where I live now, because I went to school here, and I just graduated, so that's why I'm here. And then, you know, we ended up within 4 months outgrowing that space and moving to now our facility, which is 13,000 square feet. And, you know, we're starting to quickly use up a lot of the space here. And so, you know, it helped us hire people. It helped us hire the first real full-time members and real experienced members that were not just, you know, college students or recent grads. So that really changed the life of the company. Now, some of the cons were that, you know, we weren't ready for that traffic, I think. But I'm happy we weren't ready, because we learned a lot from it, and we won't make that mistake again. But we were backordered for 13 weeks after the episode aired. And we had a bunch of supply issues and whatnot, you know, getting the product squared away and getting it ready for customers and whatnot. And it was eye-opening. I mean, it showed us, you know, the things that we were good at and the things that we were really not good at. And what that meant for me as an entrepreneur was hiring people around that, you know, that could fill that void. And I mean, that was really the biggest con of it all.
Yeah.
Although it's really a pro, to be honest.
too much work.
Yeah.
Sounds horrible. Wish we had that problem.
Alex, I know you wanted to ask, you know, kind of the financial impact of kind of the Shark Tank.
I think my, you know, I'm a regular watcher of Shark Tank. I have a 1 year old now, so I'm not really, I probably watch it or like episodes in the past, like catching up now. But the one part of it, always being an accountant, I'm always like into the numbers, you know, it's just, they start grilling you on all the metrics and things like that. And I'm thinking, how did you prepare your financials, your numbers, or whatever ratio, KPIs? What did you do to get ready for that episode?
So I was an avid Shark Tank fan as well. And so my whole life kind of growing up, I always watched it, and I really wanted to be on. It was a dream of mine to be on the show. And so when I finally got on, I had already known a lot of the questions that I was probably going to get asked, because I generally watched episodes. Yeah. And then I went back, obviously, right before I went on, and went and looked at all the different episodes and took notes on what I could do. And I was also an intern for a company in high school that was on Shark Tank. So I was very familiar with some of the questions that we might have been asked. And so I ended up writing all that down, you know, memorizing it, understanding what the numbers were and what that meant for us, how we can move away from numbers and make intuitions or references or inferences based on that. And I wanted to know, you know, if we knew what our gross margin was and we knew how much it costs to make and, you know, like what some of the numbers meant, how we could change them to better, you know, appease investors for the future. So, you know, if our gross margin or whatever it is was X at that time, we knew that, okay, well, maybe we can take a hit on the margin as long as it meant volume would increase and that we would have, you know, more cash flow coming in. And so knowing how all the numbers kind of meshed together was really important. But you know, honestly, I didn't get asked that much. So it was pretty helpful. I mean,
you get it done in 32 minutes. They don't have time for a ton of questions.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And half of that was like a good portion of that was demonstrations too. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, they really didn't have that much time for questions. And then we started getting offers and it really worked.
That's awesome, man.
So I know you can't answer this fully, and I fully understand that. But so when you get to the point where you're going to close your deal with one of the sharks, right?
Yep.
And they're taking their due diligence team and looking at your books. We have a lot of clients who either have been through this process. We work with other potential clients who are doing through due diligence. How important was it to have solid numbers to provide them to get your deal done?
Oh, incredibly important. I mean, you can't close the deal without having numbers, and you can't have the deal without having all of that kind of finished up. And so going into the tank, being 19 years old when I filmed, I made a couple of mistakes. One of the major mistakes I made since I was like, I guess, 15 or 16 when I started the company, I never filed for my taxes. Hmm. I just didn't know. I thought under 18, I didn't have to.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I really was like struggling. You know, I knew that we had to get that done, and I knew we needed a bunch of options on how to fix some of the issues that we had, which were, you know, the tax returns, and just having proper books. I never had an account. I never had a bookkeeper. Didn't have any of that prior to Shark Tank. My first full-time hire was our CFO. And then, you know, I knew we needed to get that stuff done. So before I went on, we had started the process. And by the time that we were closing the deal or in due diligence, rather, we were, I don't remember the exact timeline, but we were either very close to being done with the tax returns or we had them done. I think we didn't have them done. We were close to done. And then we supplied them and we let them know, look, like, I mean, you know, I was 16, 17 years old. I had no freaking clue to even do that. And so we just had, you know, we had to go through that. And that was tough. I mean, that's a critical moment. And we just raised our seed round, which is a lot more money for us than what we got previously. And so, you know, I think, you know, you can really get a lot out of understanding your numbers, and it's crucial, and it's something that has to get done. And, you know, for us during due diligence now, you know, we got grilled on numbers. We had the former CFO of Raytheon, who's an investor now and a board observer. And so we had to understand that, you know, we needed to really understand our numbers and be able to make roadways from understanding those numbers. And so now it's obviously very crucial, but earlier on it wasn't so crucial.
Right.
Yeah. How do you use those solid numbers you have now with your CFO to make future decisions for the company based on what you're seeing?
Yeah, well, I mean, luckily, you know, my CFO's obviously doesn't as great as his job, and my COO is a former CPA, and Got an insane amount of experience running companies. And so, you know, together we, on a weekly basis, sometimes bi-weekly basis, we look at our numbers. And me as a founder, the most important thing for me personally is cash flow. You know, I can kind of care less about the P&L for the most part, as long as cash is coming in. At least for now, because, you know, at a young stage of the company, you need the company to grow.
Makes sense.
So, you know, I think, you know, we end up looking at our numbers and we understand what's kind of the picture, and we make decisions based on that, whether we can afford to hire someone new or we can't, and what's the max that we can offer them, and so on and so forth. And so those are decisions that you have to make knowing your financials.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, I think it's awesome that like someone like your age that has so much success, just realize the importance of the financial side of the business and surround yourself with people that can really speak into that. So you have a CFO, talked about a COO who's a CPA, like that. That's just really, it's important to have those people around you who can, you know, understand the financial side, and you know, you three, and I'm sure there's other people working in tandem to really push things forward and make, you know, pretty much every decision you make has some sort of financial impact. And so understanding the financials is super important. And it seems like you have a great handle on that, which is, I'm sure led to your success. Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. So kind of continuing with that line of questioning, and it might be a financial number, it might not be, but how do you measure like the success in your business? Like, what does that look like for you? Like if you were having success now or not, you know, how do you measure that?
Well, I think it's foolish for anyone to tell anyone that success is not measured by your P&L and sales. I think that's honestly a disservice to anyone who asks, and it's a blame lie, to be honest. The number one thing is the numbers, right? And the sales that come in and the profitability. So success is directly measured by that. However, that doesn't mean that it stops there. And I think, you know, just because you either A, have a lot of money, or B, you aren't making a lot of money, you can still be successful in multiple ways. It just depends on how you look at it, right? And for us, profitability and sales goals are really the way that we measure success. And the reason why is because when we make those sales and when we make the profits that we need, we're able to make and create other initiatives and then execute on those initiatives. Yeah. So the only reason why we were able to spend, you know, in the last year, close to 100K, I'm throwing out a random number, it's not actually 100K, but it's close to it, 100K in R&D on, you know, reformulating a new product and doing a bunch of new products out there and really going big on this, you know, non-toxic and PFAS-free claim, was because we were able to make the profits and revenues beforehand and obviously raise money. But
Right. That's
kind of, you know, you can't have the other successes. You can't have the impact that you want. You can't have the social impact that you want. You can't have a lot of the other things if you don't have the most crucial thing that's fueling all of that, which is money.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, obviously there's big picture stuff. But for whether it's the top or it's right near the top, people run businesses to make money. Like you need to have money to be able to do things, to be able to, like you said, have an impact. Like it's just part of it. It's just the reality of it. So, you know, that makes a ton of sense. So I want to ask you, maybe you even touched on it already, but talk about maybe one of your biggest struggles, financial struggles as an owner, and the things or the thing that you did to overcome that?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of struggles, and they're daily struggles being an entrepreneur. I mean, it's not easy, and it's annoying.
Sure.
but you know, there are a lot of things that we can point to in terms of like certain failures or certain, I guess just issues that we've had as a company or me personally, that, you know, definitely wouldn't have it that way if I had to do it again. But, you know, some of the things that when I look at, like, for example, especially when it comes to numbers, really understanding like what your gross profit margin really is, because a lot of people think it's just, you know, the cost of the goods sold, which means, you know, the cost to make the product and that's it. But you really start to forget about all the other things that go into them, which are, I mean, generally considered selling costs. But for example, you know, like a selling cost such as the credit card processing fee, right? I mean, like 3% off of every deal. If your gross margin is like 50%, then all of a sudden you're thinking, oh, 50% is great. You know, I'm getting half, and all of a sudden, oh, it's 47 because of the credit card processing fee. And you have to, you know, consider refunds and returns and all these other things. So yep. There are a bunch of different things that I think, you know, point to things that you need to know. And you really, if you don't know, you're kind of screwed.
Right. Now that makes sense. So then on the flip side, you know, we'll talk about maybe it's going through the whole Shark Tank process. Maybe it's your cold email. Could be. But talk about one of your biggest financial victories that you've had and what maybe attributed to that or what led to that.
Well, I mean, I don't know. It's hard to point to one or two things that really lead to success for me personally and let alone anyone else. I think it's a culmination of things. I'll never say it's luck because I used to say it was luck to be humble, but now that I realize that, you know, it's more humbling to say that it's never going to be luck because it's not true. I mean, otherwise I'm blatantly lying. Because the thing is, at the end of the day, like every decision that you make as a founder, as a person, whatever, everything has a reaction and whatnot. And so, you know, you're gonna make decisions that either ultimately harm the company or don't harm the company. And so, I think there's just a lot of things. Like, I mean, being tenacious and being diligent and also just being kind of having grit and resilience, honestly. I mean, all the times that we heard no's and didn't give a shit about the no's and kept going.
Yeah.
That's not easy and that's not for everyone too. That's another thing is that, you know, sometimes you need to recognize when it's time to stop. And, you know, I didn't. that doesn't mean that I won't in the future, but for this particular endeavor, I never found that moment, the breaking point where I really just needed to say no. Although I had moments like that where I did want to give up. So, I mean, there are always times and being an entrepreneur, anyone who tells you being an entrepreneur is great is lying because it's awesome when you have the things that you want to have. But the reality of it is that, you know, it sucks. I mean, when you work for yourself, you're working 10 times, 50 times, 100 times harder than anyone else is, especially if you're really trying to be successful. And that's a sacrifice you have to be willing to make. And if you are willing to make that sacrifice, then yeah, being an entrepreneur is fantastic. But if you aren't willing to make that sacrifice, then you're in the wrong game.
Yeah, completely true. Completely true. So a couple final questions for me here. I want to switch gears a little bit. We typically don't run into a ton of entrepreneurs that have had so much success at such a young age, like you have. So just talking big picture, you know, how old are you now? 22?
Two. Yeah.
22. 22 years old, right? You're running a super successful business. Big picture, what are your goals? I mean, you have a lot of ways to go, a lot of time left. You know, what are some things that you want to accomplish, whether it's from a financial standpoint, from an impact standpoint? I'm sure you have things that you're going for. Especially with having so much success already.
Yeah. I mean, there's a new goal set every day. So, big picture things. I mean, you know, I'm running a company that is really the whole point of what we do is really to redefine the entire chemical manufacturing space. I mean, we really believe in what we're doing and we believe that chemical manufacturers should be held accountable for a lot of the atrocities that they've created. And so if you look up fluorochemicals or PFAS on Google, on the news section, you'll notice every single day there's a new article about some sort of litigation or regulation that's coming out. You can find a bunch of different options out there that might change for you or might essentially like fit for you, but not for someone else. So like my goals, you know, kind of for me are set around having a really successful company for two reasons. One, I'm trying to make money, that's for sure. But two, we do have an impact and it's a pretty big impact and we've gotten, you know, some really big attention. And so the goal is to continue with that. And I think, you know, ultimately in every founder's life, there's really three options. It's to go public and sell stock that way. It's to sell privately and sell the company to another, you know, strategic buyer, or it's to run the business forever, you know, and keep it. Personally, I mean, not that I'm super against being the world's like, you know, biggest number one for the protective coding space. I'm not necessarily convinced that I would, you know, run this company for the next 50 years. The goal is, you know, the goal is, or I guess the reality is that whatever opportunity comes and makes sense for myself and the rest of my shareholders, that's the opportunity we'll take. So if we get an opportunity to sell the company tomorrow and the opportunity is what we like and what we think is, you know, reasonable and what we want for the company, then we may consider it. Yep. But is there a really realistic chance of going public? Yeah, we'd really like that. I'm very open about it.
That's awesome. It's really cool. I have one final question for you here, and then I'll kind of pass it to Alex, see if he's anything else. Kind of reading through your bio, it seems like you're involved in a lot of things, and it appears like kind of giving back is something that's really important to you, based on some of the boards you sit on and helping with different things. So I just want to touch on why that's important to you, why that's been instilled in you, that, you know, as you're continuing to have success, and obviously you're extremely busy with running your company, but you still find time to kind of give back.
Yeah. I mean, it's important. I mean, you know, the thing is at the end of the day, what got me to be where I'm at is the mentorship that I received early on. And I wouldn't be where I am if it wasn't for all the people that believed in me and genuinely just wanted to help me. You know, Babson, the reason I went to Babson College, for example, even though I had other opportunities on the table, was just, I mean, it just made a lot of sense. I got all the resources and was able to milk the school for everything, for what it's worth, you know, and be able to get alumni and faculty and staff really, really genuinely interested in what I'm doing and that way to help me. So, you know, I think I think for me, it was just a very different approach and I chose to do what I wanted to do. And whenever I had the time, I wanted to give back because I knew one, I wouldn't have had the opportunities that I've had today if people didn't give back their time to me. And then number two, you know, you never know what's going to happen and giving back, especially if it's like helping and mentoring and helping someone get better and become a better version of themselves. I mean, there's only positives in that because that person, you know, you should never look to see, you should never think that that person owes you anything, but imagine that person, you know, a couple years from now, having their own success and then all of a sudden you guys can create success together or, you know, it makes you feel better knowing that someone else had value in what you said and was able to make a difference because of that. And so, you know, giving back is important for everyone and it should be a routine thing for everyone just because you just never know what's going to happen. And it's important to have people help other people because that's really the only way that we can learn. I mean, why learn on your own mistakes when you can learn from someone else's?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Just kind of the pay it forward mentality, you know, as because I've had people kind of walk me through things and help me as we're building our business and, you know, they've had a huge impact on me. So if I can give back to other people kind of similar to you, definitely want to do that. So that's a great mindset to have. Alex, you have any final questions here before we wrap?
No, I don't. I just want to say thank you for your time, Dave. I know you're extremely busy and we really appreciate everything you've done.
Yeah, no, thanks and, for having me.
We admire everything you built so far too.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, man. So yeah, we'll wrap up. Dave, do you have any final words or anything that you want to talk about at the end here? If you do you want to put anything out, people want to get in touch with you, or if not, not a big deal.
I'm available on all social media. You know, I lend my time as much as I can. And if anyone just wants to find me, literally my information is at David Zamarin at everything on every platform. And so, you know, whether it's advice or whether it's, you know, it's just some help or bouncing ideas off of you, you should always look to find mentorship and look to find someone that you can chat with like that. And so whether that's me or someone else, you should just go and do it.
Yeah. That's sweet, man. Appreciate that. Well, listen, thanks again for your time. And thank you everybody who tuned in here. We try to put out new podcasts every week with awesome guests like David. So we hope you enjoyed this one and we'll talk to you in the next one. Thanks for listening to the My Accountant Handles That podcast. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on LinkedIn at The Quantify Group for more awesome content related to running the financial side of your business. We'll talk to you in the next one.